I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. New York City and Cape Town, South Africa are two cities with two very different histories. This week on the show, we're talking about the history of New York and the future of Cape Town. Guy Lundy is the CEO of Accelerate Cape Town. It's a business-led initiative that brings together all the stakeholders in the Cape region to develop a long-term vision for sustainable economic growth in South Africa. He'll tell us about the unique challenges faced by Cape Town and the solutions they can share with so-called second cities all over the world. While all cities are looking to build toward the future, New York City has a legal mechanism designed to protect its past. Anthony Wood is the author of the book Preserving New York that traces the history of New York's struggle to protect its natural and architectural heritage. All that, plus the news from Nate Berg and City Views from Walker Smith coming up after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Chicago is known as the second city, but the phrase second city applies to cities all over the world that aren't the main economic driver of the nation. Cape Town, South Africa, is one such city, but for Guy Lundy, Cape Town can be a prime location for business and government to build a next-generation city. Guy is the CEO of Accelerate Cape Town, an organization that seeks to create a long-term vision for the city.
Guy, last month I made my first visit to your beautiful city, but for listeners who haven't yet had that pleasure, describe Cape Town.
Well, it's a city right on the end of the African continent, on the most southwestern point of Africa, that's flanked by two oceans. We have the Atlantic Ocean on the one side and the Indian Ocean on the other side. And the city is dominated by a very large mountain called Table Mountain. And the reason it's called Table Mountain is because it's flat on the top and looks like a table. So it's a very beautiful, iconic-looking city, very recognizable to people who have been here. And it has a lot of potential, a tremendous amount of potential as a gateway into the rest of the African continent.
And you say it has potential. Why?
Well, I think that it's something of an anomaly in terms of Africa, because it's somewhat in between Africa and Europe in a way, in that we have quite a large European population of immigrants and also people who have originated from Europe over the last 300 years. And that kind of puts us in a position where we can position ourselves as a gateway into Africa, almost as a soft landing, if you want to call it that.
With which cities do you feel a kinship, a connection?
Well, there are a few cities around the world that we would compare ourselves to, particularly second cities, those cities that are not necessarily the biggest economic driver of the country that they're in, not even necessarily the most important political cities of the country that they're in, but that have a strong identity of their own. So cities like Miami, Boston, Melbourne in Australia, Barcelona in Spain, on their own are quite significant, but not necessarily the main drivers of those countries.
Are there special qualities or challenges to second cities?
I'd say so. I think that in many cases, many countries around the world spend a lot of money, time, and energy focusing on the main cities in those countries. So if one looks particularly at Latin America, we see a lot of this in places like Santiago, Buenos Aires, São Paulo, etc. And so second cities often get left out, almost forgotten in a way. And I think that we have to work a lot harder to try and attract the best talent, attract the big companies, and attract attention from national government.
Guy, do you think there are generic strategies for second cities in overcoming some of the hurdles you just mentioned, like attracting talent, that all second cities can learn from?
I definitely think that there are lessons that second cities can teach each other. We've looked quite a lot at a city like Boston to try and understand how Boston has maintained its character, how it's kept itself on the map when it has lost a lot of its corporate headquarters to places like New York and so on. One of the lessons we pick up from Barcelona is that the most important thing to them is internal cohesion within the city, you know, because they're quite different to the rest of Spain. They speak a different language, etc. But because of the cohesion of the people within that city, they've been able to achieve a tremendous amount. So I definitely think there are some elements of strategies of second cities that are generic that can definitely be shared.
You raise two issues that are interesting. One, how do you achieve solidarity and unity within a city? Very difficult to do. Can you talk about that a little bit, particularly from your perspective at Accelerate Cape Town?
Mm-hmm. It is very difficult to do, and especially in a place like this where we have a very diverse population. You know, we have different languages, different religions, different racial groupings, etc., almost equally dispersed across the population. So people with different values, different visions of the future, etc., are quite difficult to bring together and get them all aligned. The way we're doing it here in Cape Town is to try to work as much as we can with the leadership of various groupings, and to make it quite clear to everyone that we're not trying to take over their jobs. We would really rather cooperate and collaborate with everyone as much as we possibly can. And really, it's a relationship building over time that I think is most important.
The other question you raised for me with your comment is this question of leadership, as for instance, Boston has lost its corporate headquarters. Leadership from different places has had to emerge to take over what the civic positions that were once occupied by corporate CEOs. How does Cape Town deal with that issue?
Well, we have a specific issue here in that our political leadership is very, it's not unstable, just fluid. You know, we keep changing governments here. So pretty much every 5 years we end up with a new government, a new mayor. So there's a lot of that sort of tension. And as a result, we can't really rely on the political leaders to define the future, to drive people towards that future. And as a result, what we are doing is working hard to get the corporate leaders to get engaged with the city. We have lost a couple of large corporates over the last few years, and one of the major reasons for that, I believe, is that the leadership of those corporates has not been engaged with their home, basically. And so we've started to work at bringing them together, introducing them to the other stakeholders, such as the captain of the port, the head of the airport, as chancellors of the universities, etc., in order to get them engaged so that they have more of a personal connection to the place in which the organization that they run is based.
These corporate leaders may be running businesses that are in fact global, that have less to do with Cape Town than the rest of the world, other than the fact they have to be able to attract talent to Cape Town to help them run their businesses. Where do you find the corporate leaders motivated to make the connection locally?
Well, we have a good example of a company that's headquartered in Cape Town that is leading in the media space in Asia and Latin America. They have become a very large international company. But the leadership of that organization is very clear in their minds that their home is Cape Town. On an emotional level, where they feel connected to the place. Because of that emotional sense of home, no matter how much they get out there and travel around the world, they always know that coming back to Cape Town is coming home. And that's a real leverage point that we have to use as much as possible. Because of the natural beauty of the place and because of the lifestyle that we enjoy here, it's a real leverage point that we need to utilize as much as we can to make those people feel that they are coming home when they get on that airplane back to Cape Town.
Mm-hmm. You recently undertook what I thought was a really fascinating scenarios exercise to look at possible alternative futures for Cape Town. Describe the four alternatives that you developed.
The scenario that we would least like to have, we call Sinking Island. That's an exclusive growth, low growth scenario. So the little growth that we achieve over the next 20 years, you know, let's call it 1 or 2% economic growth, is only enough to be to benefit those that already have and that are already living very well. Whereas those that are poor, unhappy, frustrated, angry, just become more so. And the reason we called it Sinking Island is we painted the picture of this peninsula that we that the city is based on kind of falling into the sea and really falling off the map as people just forget that we're even there. Nobody wants to do business here. Nobody wants to visit here as tourists, etc. So that's really the least desirable scenario that, we pointed out. The next scenario, we looked at a high growth scenario, but with exclusive growth. So the majority of the population do not benefit, and those that are in power and have economic power are the ones that benefit. We call that the Cape of Storms because we believe that that is not a sustainable, socially sustainable way of growing. You will have frustration and anger amongst those people that don't benefit. And those people that do will just be amassing wealth that enables them to get up and leave whenever things go too bad. And we believe that that would eventually slip into that sinking island scenario. The third scenario was the inclusive growth but low growth scenario. And we call that Slaapstad, which is an Afrikaans word, and it means sleepy town. So it is a situation where most people are benefiting at the same rate, but nobody's really benefiting at a particularly enjoyable rate. So it becomes a little bit like a socialist state where we're all kind of brought together by the lowest common denominator. The final scenario that we looked at, we called the Southern Tiger, and that's really a high-growth, inclusive-growth scenario. And the reason we called it the Southern Tiger was because we've looked at a lot of the lessons that have been learned in places like Ireland with the Celtic Tiger, where the kind of high growth that they experienced over the last 15 to 20 years has really benefited the whole population of Ireland.
Can you imagine a future for Cape Town that really is sinking island? Is Cape Town at risk of that?
The risk is fairly remote at the moment, but I do believe that if we allow apathy to creep in, it's not impossible. If we allowed the large corporates to leave, the entrepreneurs would leave too because they don't have people to sell to. They also won't be spending their first few years of developing their ideas and so on. It's not an impossibility. It would take a long time, 20 to 30 years of the same downward spiral, but it's one that we feel that we need to raise as something that is not an impossibility, potentially to give people the real downside of what they stand to lose. You know, the reality is that it's a fairly long way off, and it would require a tremendous amount of apathy to have that happen. But it has happened before in places like Rio de Janeiro, so we have seen that it's not impossible.
What do you have to do to make certain you achieve the best possible future of Southern Tiger?
Well, I think that the social cohesion, the working together towards a common vision and a common goal is one of the key aspects of getting there.
How do you get people organized around a vision?
Well, what we're doing here in Cape Town is that we, as a business grouping, are going out and speaking to as many of the leadership of Cape Town as possible. So we're talking to government leadership, we're talking to business leadership, communities, trade unions, etc., to get their view of what they believe the future holds. And by getting a common view and then distilling it into a common vision, we bring everybody's viewpoint into it and we get their buy-in. Without getting that buy-in, essentially what it becomes is a one-sided, imposed vision, which might work in a very homogenous society, but is really going to struggle to work in as diverse a society as we have here.
You mentioned that political leadership is changing frequently, that provincial government, city government, different parties, so they are not necessarily cohesive. What role does government play when others are leading?
Well, I think the role that government needs to play is to lead alongside their compatriots in the other sectors of society, being business, labor, etc. So I don't believe that they should be stepping back and saying, okay, well, you lead and we'll follow. But there needs to be a demarcation of responsibilities. And what is encouraging about the city of Cape Town is that particularly the mayor has identified that the city's role is really to create the enabling infrastructure and the enabling environment that can allow business to lead with growth of the economy, rather than thinking that it's the city's role to create new businesses and parastatals and so on, which is encouraging because it does mean that those that are leading in business can lead in business without worrying about being in competition with government, if you like.
What does enabling infrastructure and enabling environment look like?
Well, we're in the process of actually creating a lot of the physical infrastructure right now because we are going to be hosting the 2010 Soccer World Cup in 2010. So the physical infrastructure that's being put in place is really on a fast track. So there's a tremendous refurbishing of roads, redoing the main train station, building a new bus rapid transit system, public transport, etc. What still needs to be worked on, and I think it's going in the right direction, is a removal of some of the red tape that gets in the way of doing business. And the mayor and the city management have really identified that removing red tape has to be a priority to really create an infrastructure that enables business to happen easily rather than having to jump through several hoops before they can get anything done.
What are your biggest challenges, Guy, when you think about trying to move to this Southern Tiger future for Cape Town?
I think one of them is that we have quite a high level of inequality. South Africa is quite similar to places like Colombia, Brazil, in that it has very high highs and very low lows in terms of people's quality of life. So we do need to work quite hard at that if we're going to achieve the inclusivity that we're working towards. One of the other challenges that we face from a political perspective is, of course, as I've mentioned, some of the internal differences that we have, but also the difference that we have from the rest of South Africa as a country, which makes similar in many ways to Barcelona, as I mentioned earlier, in that the majority language is different to the rest of the country. The ruling party in the city is different to the ruling party on a national level. So there's a level of resentment at a national government level that does pose challenges in terms of getting preferential access to their steering of foreign investment towards Cape Town rather than towards somewhere like Johannesburg, for example. So those are, for me, two of the major challenges that we have, one being inequality and the other being a fundamental political difference with the rest of South Africa.
Does the image of the continent as a needy place affect your work in Cape Town?
The only area where it affects us is really in trying to promote Cape Town to the rest of the world, because the rest of the world has an image of Africa as being a very backward, very left-behind continent. I mean, the Economist magazine ran a front-page article some years ago called The Hopeless Continent, and it was about Africa. And that really makes it difficult to convince people who have never been here that this is actually an extremely sophisticated economy that we're operating in here. The image that people automatically have of anything to do with Africa is of poverty and lack of infrastructure, etc., and that's absolutely not the case here. So that's the downside of it. On the upside of it, we, as a place that has a connection into the rest of the continent, have tremendous opportunities that we can take advantage of, particularly because of the fact that we are based between the continent and the rest of the world culturally, and thus are able to connect the rest of the world and the rest of the continent quite effectively.
And what do you need to do to project Cape Town onto the world stage?
Well, I think that one of the things that we need to do from a business perspective is to develop a much more cohesive business brand and be far more aggressive about promoting that. We have a very strong and growing tourism brand. Cape Town is regularly voted internationally by things like the Condé Nast Traveler Readers Surveys as being one of the best places in the world to visit. But we do need to push a lot harder on being quite clear about what it is that we offer as a business destination and getting out in front of the eyes of the rest of the world very confidently. I think that's one of the things we've really got to work on.
Guy, thanks so much for joining us from Cape Town for Smart City.
Great. Thanks, Carol.
Guy Lundy joined us from his office in Cape Town, South Africa. He's the CEO of Accelerate Cape Town and the author of the book, South Africa, Reasons to Believe. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Fresh in the Oval Office, new President Barack Obama has reversed a controversial Bush administration decision and has called on federal regulators to reconsider a plan by California and 13 other states to require stricter fuel and emission standards for automobiles. Obama has ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to look once more at the proposal, which would require automakers to increase the mileage of their cars and trucks beyond the current national standard. According to an article in the New York Times, the move is expected to meet harsh opposition from automakers, who successfully lobbied against the plan for states to enact their own pollution and mileage standards in late 2007. But with the new administration in power, the proposal's second look is expected to meet federal approval. And meanwhile, in struggling communities across the country, the downturn in the housing market may have some redeeming qualities. A recent article from the Land Use Accountability Project looks at a growing pool of communities that are buying up and conserving land that had been slated for development before the bust. Open space is being saved or created in communities across the country, including the eastern Pennsylvania township of Buckingham, which secured a conservation easement to preserve 200 acres of land. The $5 million sale effectively blocked nearly 100 homes from being built on the land, which is protected by the easement for all time. Other communities are pulling similar sales to protect land, even in a tight economy. Land conservancies and other groups are also pitching in to buy up cheap land as developers ditch projects and values fall. Even with the downsides of the market crunch, there are at least some communities who are able to make lemonade. And as the economic recession spreads around the globe, an economic stimulus plan is on nearly everybody's mind. But while the U.S. waffles over its plan, China is 2 months deep into an economic bailout that has the entire country undergoing a major transportation facelift. The New York Times recently reported on this stimulus package, which has dedicated hundreds of billions of dollars to new highway and rail projects, including new freight rail capacity and a $24 billion high-speed rail line from Beijing to southern China. A total of $88 billion will be spent on intercity rail lines alone, and many are calling this the biggest single advancement of rail mobility since the U.S. built its own rail network in the early 1900s. So while China flashes forward with its broad countrywide plan, the U.S. stimulus remains mired in politics and almost certain to disappoint. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up on the second half of our show, we have the story of New York City's historic battle to protect its architectural and natural history. I'm Carol Coletta. And a special welcome to our podcast listeners. You've heard us talk about our social networking site, My City, and the community there has been booming. Hundreds of listeners, just like you, have joined the site and are talking and collaborating on all the issues that mean the most to people who love cities. Want to join? Send us an email to our producer, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com, and he'll get you signed up. I look forward to seeing you online. And now, back to the show. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. New York has a nationally known landmarks law that helps to protect the places in the city with grand historic significance. But the law was hard won, and though it has saved many historic buildings, many were lost in the nearly 50 years it took to pass the law. Anthony Wood has written a book about the struggle to save New York's history. It's called Preserving New York. In your book, there's a poignant 1960 photo of Gloria Swanson. She's dressed in an evening gown, elbow-length black gloves, surrounded by the ruins of the Roxy Theater in New York. How far have we come in the almost 50 years since then?
Well, the good news is we've come a long, long way. The whole notion of preservation and the recognition of the need to protect landmarks is an important part of the urban fabric to bring into the future has, I think, largely been accepted. We've actually, I think, reached the point now where even when a new building is built, people say it's an instant landmark. So people see the value in it. So I think today people are not arguing over the fact that it's important to save buildings. I think now the arguments are more over particular buildings and actually how to save them.
What began to turn things around?
Well, I think the historical change occurred with a lot of the events that cities were experiencing in the late 50s. And people seeing destruction really going light speed. And in fact, buildings, you know, built that people had seen actually built only a few decades before even being threatened and torn down, just because the pace of change began to accelerate so much in the late 50s and into the early 60s.
Was there any one teardown that galvanized attention to this issue in New York?
You know, one of the actual reasons for my book was I, like so many other people, thought there was just one building that explained it all, and that would, of course, be Penn Station and the tragic loss of Penn Station. And when I came to New York now about 30 years ago, I wanted to learn the history of how the preservation movement in New York started. I'm a historian by nature, and I wanted to get involved in preservation, so it was just kind of my interest. And as I dug deeper, every time, you know, somebody said, well, it all started with Penn Station, I began to find more and more incidents and historical episodes before Penn Station that just didn't fit with that answer, that it was all Penn Station. There were all these things going on in the late 50s, and then I kept digging backward and further back. So Penn Station is certainly the event most people associate as being the event that kicked New York into having a landmarks law. And it certainly did have a huge impact on awareness. But actually, it was a series of threats and a series of events over the decades that ultimately led us to really inventing the landmarks law.
Tony, let's go back. You write in your book about the City Beautiful movement. That movement affected many cities. Describe how it affected New York.
What was terrific about that was New Yorkers and people from all over the country flocked to Chicago to see that fair. And there they saw on the shores of the Great Lake the great white city. They saw how a city could actually be if it was well designed, if it was coordinated, if aesthetics helped drive the agenda, if quality of life was a concern. And prior to that, the only glimpses people have had of an alternative city was when they all did the great European tours, you know, and the architects would take the tour and they go and see the European cities. Well, here, it was an example, we could do this in America. And so the New Yorkers that flocked there, and there were many New York architects involved with the Chicago World's Fair, but they came home inspired, saying, if they can do it on the shores of the Great Lakes, we can do it on the shores of the Hudson.
Robert Moses, of course, is a looming figure in the story of New York. Describe his role.
In my story and in the story I have put together on the origins of the landmark law, he's the Darth Vader character, if you will. He was the Jedi Knight, you know, the reformer who went to the dark side of the Force. And basically, when I say that, he abandoned any commitment to kind of process and civic functioning and fell prey to the dreams, the powerful visions of projects and doing whatever it took to get those projects built. So part of it was a behavioral thing, and part of it was, frankly, a different vision. And Moses really personifies the vision of the 50s about progress. The progress was new. Progress was not about anything dealing with the past. So Moses plays a critical role in actually the landmark movement because he's so antagonized and his excesses so disturbed otherwise, you know, genteel civic leaders who I think would have preferred to, you know, sip a sherry in their private club, but it kind of forced them into civic action to defend the city they cared so passionately about from somebody who was basically ignoring all the processes. You know, in the past, people had listened to reason. You know, if a civic group had an objection, there was an opportunity to talk it through. But Moses so cut them out of the process and so antagonized them that they really rose up. And it was on a citywide basis. It was neighborhood by neighborhood. So if you look at the great civic leaders that emerged, most of them cut their teeth on a battle, different ones, but on different battles with Robert Moses.
In the last couple of years, of course, New York has explored the Robert Moses legacy. What was the good part of that legacy?
Well, the good part, I mean, it's true. People have been lately trying, what some of them are calling rehabilitating Robert Moses. The legacy that Moses leaves us as positive is he shows that we can build, we can continue to build great things, that we can transform pieces of our urban environment that need to be, that we are a society that can obtain visions. The problem is that, unfortunately, Moses, I'm going to say, took the easy way of doing that by basically riding roughshod over process and riding roughshod over democracy, in a sense. And so the challenge is, can we build wonderful things, but do it in a way that engages the civic process and the citizens and democracy, and not by just being a steamroller rolling over legitimate concerns and interests?
Where in the nation did the preservation movement really get its start?
In a lot of ways, it got its start in places like Charleston, South Carolina, and the Vieux Carré in New Orleans, where whole neighborhoods remain, for a variety of reasons, intact. So in New York, in the late 40s and in the 50s, as development pressures began to eat into the fabric of places like Greenwich Village and Brooklyn Heights, New Yorkers looked frequently to Charleston, South Carolina, and they looked to the Vieux Carré and to find methodologies for, you know, if those neighborhoods could be protected, how can we do that in New York? So when it came to historic neighborhoods, those were the cities that always kind of rolled off people's tongues.
It's interesting when you compare what was happening in New York to Charleston, South Carolina, or certainly to New Orleans. I mean, those are cities in so many ways that are frozen in time. Neither of them, you would say, has great notable architecture in a modern sense. How do you, in fact, make a place for historic buildings and neighborhoods alongside great new dynamic contemporary work?
Well, I guess a city like New York is lucky because we are so vast that, you know, at the moment, I think depending on how you add up or run your numbers and what you're measuring, but less than 3% of New York City is presently protected in any way by kind of landmark constraints, if you will. So say that somebody felt that we need to double what we've done. You still leave so much of the city open still for exciting new architecture. So in a sense, we've got the space in our city to allow the best of the new along with the preservation of the best of the past and the past that we want to include in the future of our city.
How do you make a decision about which past you want to include in the future?
That's the fun challenge and debate that goes on over time. And one of the great things that we, for us in New York, is that our landmarks law was written with the conscious recognition that attitudes and tastes were going to change over time. So when the law was written and passed in 1965, it didn't spell out what a landmark should be based on a particular style of building. For instance, back then, Victorian architecture was hated. So if they had, and Art Deco and some of the things we love today wouldn't have registered at all in those people's minds, but instead they came up with a fluid definition that basically allows, as our tastes change, they can be reflected in what society feels is important to protect and bring into the future.
What led to the 1965 preservation law?
Basically, what happened was change got so out of control in the 50s and in the early 60s, with Greenwich Village and Brooklyn Heights suffering losses, with great buildings and kind of recognized on a citywide basis coming down and others being threatened, that I think what finally happened was the city seemed to be so out of control that the mayor and the city council almost had no choice but to embrace and pass the landmarks law, which had been dreamed of for, you know, decades prior to its passage. But finally, events reached the point where there was a legal remedy on the table that could save buildings. And by then, a growing, loud, diverse constituency of New Yorkers demanding that something be done to save pieces of their city that were literally being torn down in front of their eyes almost on a daily basis. And so the mayor had no choice but to pass the law. And the law was actually propelled by a series of buildings that were lost and others whose fate was kind of hanging in the balance. And so they finally passed the law in the spring of 1965.
And who was the mayor at the time?
Mayor Wagner.
Did the law break any new ground in terms of preservation law around the country?
It did, in the sense that the New York law dealt with two separate issues that many cities had only dealt with one of, or if they dealt with both, they did them separately. But our law figured out both how to address the need to protect great individual buildings, you know, the Chrysler buildings, the Empire State buildings, the great icons, but as well as to come up with a mechanism to protect historic neighborhoods like Greenwich Village and Brooklyn Heights. So it had a mechanism for both individual buildings as well as for historic districts.
Did the law allow for reasonable changes to protected buildings and protected neighborhoods at the time?
Absolutely. And in fact, just as the definition of what a landmark is flexible in the law and is really is in the hands of the Landmarks Commission, you know, that's functioning at any moment in time, also the definition of what was appropriate, what was an appropriate addition or change to a landmark is basically determined by the Landmarks Commission that's sitting at that moment in time, which again allows the process to reflect changing attitudes and changing beliefs. So the law allowed for change. I mean, some people have an incorrect notion that when a neighborhood is, for instance, made a historic district, it freezes it in time. And in reality, you know, change is constantly going on. The difference is it's managed change.
Since the law was passed under Mayor Wagner, have you had mayors in New York who have been openly hostile to preservation?
I don't think any have identified themselves as being against preservation. We've certainly had mayors, unfortunately more in recent time than in the past, that I'd say have been less sympathetic to preservation and have less seen its value. Mayor Giuliani, I'm afraid, fits in that category, who really didn't appreciate the important role preservation could play for the city and in the vitality in the city and in helping it economically.
It seems that celebrities have always played a role in preservation in New York. I think about the High Line in recent years. Some of us remember Jacqueline Kennedy's involvement in New York and the preservation movement. Have celebrities, in fact, been essential to gaining for preservation the attention that it required to get the laws passed?
It certainly has always helped the cause. Celebrities bring a certain imprimatur. They help suggest a concept or an approach isn't, you know, far out there. It isn't marginal. It isn't on an extreme, but it is something central to many people and something that can be embraced by mainstream figures. Celebrities certainly help capture the public attention, and there's so many things competing for public attention and press attention that celebrities have helped focus, you know, whether it's the mic or the camera or the newspaper editorial on preservation and helped it get the attention that it deserves. So I think that celebrities have probably played a greater role since the law was passed in 1965, but even when you go back earlier,
cities naturally evolve and change. Do you think there have been times when preservationists have gone overboard, have tried to save buildings they shouldn't have saved?
I personally don't. When I think back of my involvement in preservation the last 30 years and then what I discovered writing the history, I can't find a building or a neighborhood that anyone has regretted saving. But I certainly can come up with a long list of buildings and places that we've lost that we really regret having lost. So I don't feel preservation has gone overboard at all. And I think, again, when you look at, frankly, the small percentage of what we have protected in New York compared to the richness of the history we have, I still think we've got a long way to go in what we'd like to protect and bring into the future. I'm afraid I'm certainly comes down in the category that I haven't found, no one's pointed yet to me to a particular building or neighborhood that we regret saving. And the fact, for instance, at the moment that there are, I think, over 50 neighborhoods or pieces of neighborhoods seeking historic district status and endless individual buildings that people are pushing to be designated shows that, if anything, people want more of what we care and love in this city, given the degree of protection that comes with some sort of landmark status.
And that makes sense for the most part, but just to push back a moment, isn't it also, though, a means of staving off change in a way that it's sort of a not in my backyard or not those people or density, yes, but not here?
Certainly, you know, if you look at certain preservation fights, there have been people who've been motivated by reasons or by forces that the land marsh law really wasn't created to respond to. But I try and separate the motive from the merit. And so I've seen a lot of things worthy of landmark protection, worthy of designation, that have been supported by people who are pushing that for perhaps the wrong reasons, but the resource they're pushing to be protected does meet exactly what the landmarks law was designed to protect. So I think one does, in my mind, you've got to tease out the motives of people and not let that undercut the fact that if indeed it's a meritorious neighborhood that's being promoted or an individual building, if someone's pushing for the wrong reason, that's too bad. But if it meets the standards of the law, it shouldn't be, in a sense, disqualified because of the motives of some of its supporters.
You spoke of the long list of neighborhoods and buildings that have been lost in New York that you regret. What's the biggest regret? What is your biggest regret?
Well, I guess with so many New Yorkers, if I experienced it, it was as a child so young I have no memories. I think it is Penn Station. I mean, just because it's the iconic power of when you look at photos of that and the huge vastness of that loss in terms of the huge hole it created in the city. So I suspect the silver lining, though, is if we hadn't lost Penn Station, I think it would have taken even longer for us to have had to have ended up with a landmarks law.
Thanks so much for being our guest, Tony, on Smart City.
Oh, well, delighted. Thank you.
Anthony Wood is the executive director of the Idelson Foundation, a professor at Columbia College, and the author of Preserving New York. His interview was engineered by Amber Cortez. Finally this week, when the weather turns nasty, it can leave you feeling a little helpless. This week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith is reminded of some freak weather and how sometimes bad things can happen to good people.
Back in 2002, the Upper South was clobbered by one of those storms of the century. An ice storm blanketed North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia during the night and early morning hours of December 4th and 5th. 2 million people in the Carolinas lost power, and the governor of North Carolina dispatched the National Guard into 21 counties to go door-to-door and offer assistance. During the aftermath, a Duke Power spokesperson said that it was taking, quote-unquote, heroic efforts by its crews to cope with the damage. Many cities and communities experienced record amounts of freezing rain, and new records for an extreme weather event were set all across the region for power outages, traffic accidents, school closings, and fatalities. To put it in perspective, the previous record for power outages had been set by Hurricane Hugo in 1989. Some areas, especially Charlotte and Raleigh, North Carolina, were effectively shut down for over a week. FEMA moved in to provide disaster relief, and 37 counties in North Carolina were declared federal disaster areas. The company I work for is headquartered in the Research Triangle area of North Carolina, which was one of the hardest hit by this storm. What I remember most about it is the experience of a person we had just hired a few months before to run our sales group. He had moved his wife and two young daughters with their two cats and three birds from the Bay Area in California just a few weeks before. When the storm hit, they were still unpacking moving boxes. They were without power for over a week and knew virtually no one in the area. When they were finally able to get out of their neighborhood to restock groceries, they had no place to cook meals. So each evening they drove over icy roads to the office, which was closed, but which had power. Nobody at the office knew they were having to do this, but there in the small kitchen in the office break room, they would microwave their meals and have a family dinner. We joke about it now, but I sometimes think about it as a reminder of just how fragile our connection to well-being can be. If we are not prepared and resilient, an unexpected turn of events can wipe us out. And this need not be the weather. In fact, the slowing economy has done this very thing to millions of Americans in recent months. When it's the weather, though, everybody gets immediate help. When it's the economy, we tend to forget that the plight in which people find themselves is not all their fault. Economic storms can also overwhelm our best planning and reserves and sever our fragile connections to well-being. And no less than what we do for those made homeless by Mother Nature, so too must we do for those made homeless by the fickle and often perverse swings of the almighty dollar. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. We want to hear from you. You can contact us through our website at smartcityradio.com and click the contact button. While you're there, you can listen to archive shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. You can also email us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Additional support provided by National Trust Main Street Center, revitalizing America's traditional business districts to build sustainable communities. Visit www.mainstreet.org. Scotty Iseri is our night owl of a producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.